The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Balance of Power. Yeah, happy Monday. We got news. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. I'm glad you're with us here on the radio, on the satellite, and on YouTube, where you can find us right now if you search Bloomberg Global News. Find our live stream and join me here inside the terminal because we've got the budget. It just dropped. We're going to get into this a bit more with Douglas Holtz Eakin coming up in a few moments, but I want to give you the news as investors have been waiting for this. Remembering the president's budget is a statement of values. $7.3 trillion, there's your headline, dollars, fiscal year 2025. We haven't figured out the one we're living in right now, but we're on to 25. $621 billion domestic discretionary spending. Deficits would fall $3 trillion if they approve taxes on the rich and corporations. U.S. debt hitting $45 trillion in a decade. The president is asking, here we go, $895 billion for defense-related programs. We'll have much more on this as we work our way through the hour here. As the White House says, indeed, it will reduce the deficit by about $3 trillion, but you got to pass some tax hikes to make that happen, and we can't even pass an actual budget. Meantime, the president making news over the weekend on Israel. Ramadan began yesterday. And as you remember, walking into the State of the Union last week, the hope was to have a ceasefire in place by then. It did not happen. And the president now referring to red lines when it comes to Israel, warning Benjamin Netanyahu, as I read in the headline, not to attack Rafah as Ramadan begins. And that is where we start our conversation with Ian Marlowe, Bloomberg senior reporter covering diplomacy. And boy, we could use some now, Ian. It's great to see you. Thank you for making us part of your Monday. We start talking about red lines. We think about Barack Obama in Syria. The messaging here is getting pretty complicated. What's the president doing?
I think he's kind of grasping at straws to some degree. I think the U.S. is facing, you know, several months into this, you know, 5 months into this conflict, the real possibility that they just don't have as much leverage over Israel as they would like. Yeah. They're airdropping aid when there's plenty of land borders with Gaza. Mm-hmm. They're now talking about, as President Biden said in the State of the Union, they're going to be creating a temporary pier to bring in aid by sea. Mm-hmm. Sort of everything except pressuring Israel to the degree that would actually bring about significant change in the humanitarian situation, which is getting incredibly dire with, you know, famine, starvation, and the rest of it looming.
So now it's like public diplomacy. He's speaking through the media, a hot mic moment at the State of the Union. When he said that to Jerry Nadler, I'm going to have a come to Jesus meeting with Bibi, did he want that to go out to the world?
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's hard to know with both Biden and Netanyahu here, because they are both dealing with really intense international and domestic situations. I mean, Biden's facing an election here. Yeah. Netanyahu will face an election as soon as the war ends. He's got people in his far-right coalition that want even tougher stance on, you know, on Gaza, no aid getting in, you know, crushing Hamas, you know, going into Rafah, where there's all, you know, more than a million civilians sheltering. It's a complicated dance right now. And I think the harsh words and rhetoric we're seeing now is an example of that behind the scenes diplomacy failing to take hold. And that diplomacy, the hostage talks, the talks about what happens in Gaza the day after, all of that is continuing, but all of it can still founder on Bibi, basically saying no.
To what extent does Ramadan factor into the chances of a ceasefire happening now? Does this put talks on ice for a month, or will they continue?
At the moment, I think privately, U.S. officials are thinking that Hamas is going to wait a little bit until Ramadan rolls out a tiny bit so they can see whether that little space will allow the region to heat up. Maybe we'll see protests. Maybe we'll see protests, in the West Bank or across the region, perhaps more violence. And that might put pressure on Israel, the U.S. and allies to try and get to the table more. That is the sense from the West about what they think Hamas is doing. But at the moment, no one really knows. And I think, obviously Biden had hoped, for a Monday or two ago for this hostage deal to be done, still not done, and it doesn't look like it's going to be done in time for, definitely not in time for Ramadan.
Certainly
at least
not.
Beginning.
Just lastly, Ian, there was a big supplemental budget request that was mostly geared toward Ukraine but had billions for Israel. Is that off the table now? Or are we still going to send that money if it's ever approved?
I think the thing is now they're sending a lot of military aid sort of below the threshold where they need congressional approval. So a lot of that has still been going on. I think that's sort of nuts and bolts, repairs, extra equipment and things like that. I don't think it's clear exactly what's going to happen with that in terms of the broader funding. But I don't think there's any sense at the moment that Israel is in dire straits, unlike Ukraine, right?
Yeah,
that's a separate
conversation.
Different. Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you could come talk to us. Ian Marlow, Bloomberg senior reporter covering diplomacy. Look for him on the terminal and online as the president draws a red line in Israel. It's an important moment. I'm glad you could share it with us, Ian, with great reporting, as always, here at Bloomberg News. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. Turning back to the budget that just dropped, and this is the day we've been waiting for, remembering, of course, that this is not the budget that will pass. It's not only coming from the White House before Congress gets its hands on it, but we're in the middle of a campaign season. So all of this is, as we hear every year, a statement of values. The question is, can any of this get through the House and the Senate? Could this, in fact, be the framework, the skeleton of a budget? Here's an even crazier question. Will we have a budget in 2025? Still haven't found one in 24. Douglas Holtz-Eakin used to do this for a living when he was, of course, chief economist, the president's Council of Economic Advisors. He's now president of the American Action Forum and joins us. Douglas, it's great to see you. Happy Budget Day. I specifically asked for you so we could get your read on this, and I'm glad you could join. The headlines are just rolling, and I want to just let everybody know that this came out at noon, so Douglas hasn't exactly been able to pore over this with the green visor. Just broadly, though, Douglas, how do you look at a budget from the administration? What parts are you looking for to get a sense of what might happen to the actual spending debate here in Washington, not the campaign?
Well, I think there are two big things you look for in a budget. Number one, how much deficit reduction do you get? It takes something like $8 trillion over the next 10 years to stabilize debt relative to GDP. This budget won't contain $8 trillion deficit reduction. So we're still going to see the debt rising and rising more rapidly than the economy. Second thing you look for is what steps are being taken to slow the growth rates of Social Security and Medicare. We're going to spend about $82 trillion over the next 10 years. Nearly $35 trillion of that will be Social Security and Medicare. Those are the big programs in the budget. They grow faster than everything else. They grow faster than revenues possibly will. 7% for Medicare, 5.5% for Social Security. This budget won't contain anything that's going to slow the growth of Social Security and Medicare. So it's a statement of campaign values, but it is not a serious fiscal document.
Wants to raise taxes. We've heard this before from President Biden, raising taxes specifically on the wealthy. Billionaires would get a minimum 25%. He wants corporate taxes higher, and that is the justification for lower deficits in this plan. Douglas, they say deficits would fall $3 trillion with these tax hikes approved, but we all know that is not going to happen, right?
They want to raise the corporate rate up to 28%. The trouble with that, of course, is since it was cut down to 21%, we haven't lost the headquarters to a U.S. corporation, and we used to lose about 10 a year. And so that problem got fixed, so now they're now threatening to unfix it. I don't think Congress would go along. They want to join the international 20% minimum tax. Congress has shown no interest in that. And they want to raise this book income alternative tax from 15 to 21%. Mm-hmm. You will recall that the Treasury threw up its hands last year and said, we're not going to collect this 15% tax. We don't know how. So that's hardly reassuring if you're going to make the rate higher and you still haven't collected a dime the last time around. All in all, these are, you know, making the point that we want to tax corporations, we want to tax affluent individuals, but they're not proposals that are likely to get over the finish line.
Here's your reality check. And as I read further down, Douglas Holtz-Eakin, the president is calling on Congress to apply his cap. It's a $2,000 cap on drug costs, $35 insulin cap for all, not just Medicare. That's playing pretty well on the campaign trail. This has been one of the things that the president talks about that is received very well. Why doesn't Congress approve that? Why doesn't the Republican majority in the House take it away from him?
Well, there's a pretty small fraction of Americans who have more than $2,000 in drug costs every year, something like 3% or so. So you're going to cap everyone at $2,000. That's a pretty broad insurance mandate. How are they going to pay for that? Well, they're going to have to raise premiums. So this is a recipe for higher premiums on every health insurance policy in the United States. I don't see members of Congress who are up every 2 years being too eager to get into that discussion. Insulin is a different matter. That's a pretty popular idea, and it's popular proven by the fact that every pharmaceutical company offers insulin at $35 a month. They have a private program to do that. So the Medicare proposals, the health insurance proposals are not quite as practical as they appear to be appealing on the campaign trail.
Yeah, sure. Now, you and I are having this conversation with a straight face. We're getting wonky on this stuff, and that's what we do. But the fact of the matter is we don't have a real budget for 2024, and I'm just not sure if we're ever, you can tell me, going to get one for 25. We're actually under a laddered CR right now, that with the second half set to expire on March 22nd. And if you watch or listen to this program, you don't need me to tell you about it. God love this audience. They're dialed in. Douglas, I wonder if it's more likely we shut down on the 22nd or actually get a budget for 2025.
Well, certainly there is a threat of a shutdown, but I think the good news is that from all of the political polling that I have seen and people I've talked to, a shutdown hurts Republicans dramatically in the fall. And they don't want that. So there is an incentive for the House to get it together and compromise, get these over the finish line and put the 2024 budget, which began October 1st, 2023, so we're way behind schedule, put that in the rearview mirror. Yeah. And then see if they can get to yes on the next year's budget during the campaign season. I'm a little pessimistic on that front.
About which part? Whether we go beyond the 22nd?
Oh, no. I think we'll get that done. I think that's in the political interest. But, you know, we now should be doing the 2025 budgeting. And
right.
I don't see that getting done in an election season.
Yeah, that's – God, we're just going to get used to this stuff. The president did sign the first – minibus over the weekend, $460 billion. That's the first six bills. The other six are in the next package, which actually is a much larger portion of the budget. And as you know, Douglas, it includes HHS, it includes Homeland Security, the Pentagon, the sticking points here, the stuff that no one can seem to figure out. What makes you optimistic that they get this done?
Take the polling on the House Republican side. They have
it's as simple
advantage.
As that, though. You don't want to be blamed for it.
No, look, I mean, it's real simple. They have a big advantage on the immigration issue. If they close the government, they lose it entirely. So Republicans have finally a reason to get to the table with Democrats in the House, you know, in the Senate, that's already happened. And so we're going to see the same movie we saw with the first minibus. At the last minute, they will put this on the House floor under, quote, suspension of the rules. They'll get a two-thirds majority. It'll be carried a lot by Democrats, also some Republicans, and we will finally have the budgeting in place for the remainder of the fiscal year.
That would be a small miracle around here. We avoid the sequester in that case. And then we start looking at the next fiscal year. I can't imagine how that would actually proceed. You don't think we get a real budget for 25. Do we go through the motions, or is the House essentially closed after this?
So the House Budget Committee actually marked up a budget resolution. They did it the day of the State of the Union, and they will vote on that in the House Budget Committee. The Senate Budget Committee has shown no interest in doing any budget work this Congress, so I don't think they'll do anything. And so we won't have a real congressional budget process. We'll get the president's budget today. They'll look over it, and they'll start negotiating about the kind of spending they could maybe agree on after the election. But I think we're doomed to a continuing resolution from September 30th through the election.
Wow. All right. We'll play this tape back. Douglas, thank you. I'm glad you could join today. Happy budget day, even if it's not real. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, the president of the American Action Forum. He's been inside the bubble, was chief economist, the president's council of economic advisors, 2001 to 2002, the Bush White House.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
You know, Joe, typically, if you were to say something like, we're going to quadruple the tax on stock buybacks, raise the corporate tax rate to 28%, financial markets wouldn't necessarily react really well to that. Right. And yet that's exactly what we got in the budget outlined by President Biden. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem like it's making too much of a dent, which probably speaks to the fact that the market is acknowledging that the likelihood of this becoming reality is probably lower than it is higher.
Yeah, it tends not to be a pass-through. There's going to be a debate. The question is, will there be a budget at the end of that debate? And as we'll discuss coming up with Congressman Seth Moulton, we haven't figured out how to do it this fiscal year. So why would one in a campaign cycle be any different? And that's going to be a big question here. Yeah. Although Republicans did mark up a 2025 plan last week. Speaking of aspirational, everyone's dancing to their own music. Mike Dorning knows about that music. He's been covering Washington for a minute, and he's with us now. Bloomberg's deputy congressional editor. Mike, it's great to see you. That's how this works, right? The problem is this year, we haven't figured out how to keep the lights on. And
we're in a total gridlock at the moment because there's a very different view of what the government should be doing. They're blocked, fighting each other. This budget should be viewed as aspirational. This is what Biden if he were reelected and got not only a Democratic Congress, but a Democratic Congress that didn't include people who disagreed with him like Joe Manchin. That said, you know, this is like, you know, we had the State of the Union speech last mm-hmm. week. This is a little bit of how the rubber meets the road with that vision that Biden, you know, presented. And as far as like a budget getting done in an election year, I give the chances very low. Usually or often what they do is just wait until after the election to deal with like how they're going to spend.
So could be looking at another CR after September 30th of this year, after the series of CRs that were kicked off after September 30th of last year.
Yes, but that would be kind of different. It wouldn't be as dysfunctional.
Sure.
It would be basically saying, hey,
this is what it's come
we'll
to.
Wait till after the election, then we'll see where we all stand,
and
then we know who has what kind of power, and then we can make a deal.
Well, and just for the dose of reality, Steve Scalise, the number two in House Republican leadership, just said they reject Biden's budget proposal. The price tag, he says, if the proposed budget is yet another glaring reminder of this administration's insatiable appetite for reckless spending. Goes on to say the budget doesn't just miss the mark, it is a roadmap to accelerate America's decline. So I guess there
shocker.
We have it, Mike.
They're not gonna, if Biden thinks it's a good idea, gosh, we'd be for it.
That gives you a sense of where we're starting here. Can we maybe back up a second before we talk to Congressman Moulton, Mike? Are we going to shut down on the 22nd? There's no guarantee that this next package of six bills will get done either, right?
There's no guarantee. That said, you know, I've continued to view that the Republicans and the Democrats have both shown their hands on this, that neither side wants a shutdown of the government in an election year. Speaker Johnson has signaled again and again that he is willing to come to a deal to avoid a shutdown, whether that's kicking the can down the road as he did every other time or actually reaching the ultimate deal as he did with about a quarter of the funding for government.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't expect there's much of a likelihood of an actual government shutdown before, you know, in this fiscal year at least.
How about that?
All right.
At least there's that.
Yeah. Yes. Although we'll see. A lot can happen in the next 2 weeks. Mike Dorning, who is our deputy team leader of congressional coverage here at Bloomberg.
Thank you so much
for joining us. And now joining us is Congressman Seth Moulton, Democrat from Massachusetts, who, of course, is very much involved in all of these different spending battles. Congressman, thank you so much for coming back to Bloomberg Television and Radio. Do you have an understanding of where we stand in these next six appropriation bills that need to be passed by the 22nd? Are we going to get another, I guess, megabus is what we decided to call it? What's the plan?
Well, that's definitely the plan. The plan is to do exactly what we did last week, which is combine these appropriations bills together, work out the differences, and then pass them as one package against the objections of the extremist Republicans who always vote against just simply having a budget, basically. So that is the plan. The challenge is that this group of appropriations bills is just more contentious. It's more challenging. And I was speaking with a Republican colleague last night about this. I mean, he's cautiously optimistic, but at the end of the day, it's up to the Speaker of the House to quell the opposition on the far right. And the Speaker's worried that if he goes too far, they're going to do the same thing to him that they did to Kevin McCarthy, which is just kick him out of Congress or out of the speakership.
What do you make of Congressman, it's good to see you, by the way. Welcome back. What do you make of Steve Scalise's statement here? Kaylee just mentioned this. It's a roadmap to accelerate America's decline. That's quite a starting point when it comes to a debate, isn't it?
I mean, this is just typical for Steve Scalise. I mean, you know, if President Biden were to save a young girl from a fast rushing stream, Steve Scalise would criticize him for it. So it doesn't really mean much of anything at all. The fact of the matter is the president has put down his vision for the country, and that's important for a president to do. I think it's especially important for a president to do in an election year. The contrast here with Republicans is that they want to preserve these massive tax cuts for the wealthy that have ballooned our deficit. They are the ones who have been terribly fiscally irresponsible. I mean, the deficit just went up like trillions of dollars under Donald Trump, and they want to go back to that again. That's what they're defending. So when President Biden just says, look, I think everybody should pay their fair share, it's important for Americans to know that Republicans disagree with that. They think the rich should pay less.
Well, of course, the president is also requesting a few things from Congress, including renewing his call for supplemental funding for Ukraine and American allies and border security. We all know the fate of that original supplemental deal after it was struck, very quickly died. Something did indeed pass the Senate. Very unclear what happens in your body going forward, sir. But we do know that perhaps a discharge petition could be one way around House Speaker Mike Johnson if he decides not to put Ukraine aid on the floor. Are you confident that that would work?
No, I'm not confident. And this is a very big problem for our national security, because supporting Ukraine is not just about defending these amazing freedom fighters in Europe. It's about protecting Europe from the onslaught of Vladimir Putin. And it's about sending a message to Xi Jinping and China that democracies are going to stand together, that allies are going to stand up for each other, and that ultimately that means he should not start World War III in the Pacific by invading Taiwan. So I think people forget just how high the stakes are here. Now, most Democrats and Republicans in Congress do understand this. The issue is that Republicans, again, are feeling pressure from the extreme isolationists on the far right who are against funding Ukraine, who just simply don't understand the basic principles of national security. Now, to Speaker Johnson's credit, I think that he understands that this is important. And in his heart of hearts, he wants to do it. The question is whether he'll have the courage to stand up to these Freedom Caucus extremists and do the right thing for our national security, the right thing for freedom and democracy, or whether he'll cave to them because, again, he's afraid that they'll kick him out of the speaker seat.
Well, the fact that we're still asking about this does make you wonder, Congressman. Speaker Johnson has not shown his cards on this. He says he'll work against the discharge petition that Kaylee mentioned, but we have no sense about when or if ever Ukraine funding comes to the floor. Are we entering a world now in which Ukraine may never get more funding from the U.S.?
I mean, that is a distinct possibility under this Republican leadership. I mean, the speaker has not been able to do anything. He doesn't have a plan. His biggest accomplishments to date are not shutting the government down. And even that, he's had to go against the extremists in his caucus to do. So, I mean, this is what Americans get when they have this Republican Party that is in the middle of a civil war leading the House of Representatives. There's no leadership. There's no plan. I wish I could tell you that this is what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to go about it. Here are the challenges. Here's why I think it will work. But there is literally no plan. All we know is that there are good Republicans who want to do the right thing. Democrats are standing by to do the right thing and inevitably bail the Republican Party out when they can't lead. But we are absolutely facing the possibility of both a shutdown and the possibility that we abandon Ukraine and send a message to China that, hey, go ahead, start a war in the Pacific because we're not going to do anything. And that's ultimately very dangerous. There are truly American lives on the line when you think about the long-term consequences here.
Well, and of course, Congressman, it's not just aid for Ukraine that is in question. Aid for Israel is tied up in this as well. But I'd like to ask you about some of the rhetoric we heard from both President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the weekend, when Biden, in an interview, suggested that if Israel were to invade Rafah, where there are a million Palestinians who have sought refuge there, that that would be a red line. Netanyahu went on to say that his only red line is that October 7th does not happen again. But, sir, what good are red lines if the U.S. still says it will stand by Israel? Support for Israel, military support for Israel will continue. What leverage does the president actually have here?
Well, let's just step back for a minute. I mean, this is an incredibly complicated and divisive situation, but there are a few principles that we should all agree with. First of all, Israel has a right to exist and an obligation to defend itself. But second of all, you're not going to ever have peace in the Middle East if you don't have Palestinian rights. And I think that for all the critics of a two-state solution, no one's been able to come up with a better idea. Palestinians and Israelis both deserve to live in peace and freedom, to have democratic rights, to have a national state. And ultimately, both Israeli and Palestinian innocent people should not be killed. And the scope of the human tragedy unfolding in Gaza is just unbelievable and heartbreaking. And at the end of the day, as we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan, as speaking as a Marine veteran here who's fought in a counterinsurgency, if Netanyahu continues killing so many innocent civilians, he's going to lose the war. because he's just serving as a recruitment tool for Hamas. So the issue here is that Netanyahu fundamentally has to go. What he's doing is morally bankrupt. It's militarily bankrupt. It's not going to work. And so therefore, what he's really doing is pursuing his own interests and not Israel's. And you hear this from the Israeli people. I mean, Netanyahu has the lowest approval ratings I think we've ever seen for a prime minister. Even in the midst of a war, people can't stand him. I had the opportunity to speak with a hostage family just after the State of the Union. And I brought up this concern. I said, look, we support Israel's right to defend itself. Everyone should want to get rid of this terrorist organization, Hamas. You're never going to have a Palestinian state if Hamas is around. But I really disagree with what Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing. I think his strategy is failing. And without missing a beat, this hostage family chimed in and said, well, his first failure was the fact that he let our guard down with his political division and October 7th happened in the first place. So there is just widespread dissatisfaction with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. And so when you hear President Biden just echoing those same sentiments, I don't think anybody should be surprised.
Well, we're always curious your thoughts on our policy in Israel as well as Ukraine from your view on the Armed Services Committee. And as a combat veteran, Congressman, I'd like to, in our remaining moment, tap your expertise as a member of the China Select Committee. It appears that the TikTok bill that could result in the banning of TikTok will end up on the floor for a full House vote on Wednesday. Will it pass? Should it?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. This bill does not ban TikTok. It just bans the Chinese Communist Party from essentially owning and influencing. Right. That's a very important distinction, because what TikTok is doing is sending out messages to all its users to call people like me and say, don't ban TikTok. Well, that's not what we're doing at all.
Yeah.
We're not trying to ban TikTok. I hope it gets a vote. I think that we don't need the Chinese Communist Party telling our kids what to watch online, which is essentially what's going on here. And I just want to see TikTok survive and thrive, but under American protections, in American hands. And everyone, I think, here in America should want that, too.
All right. I won't call it a ban. I'm putting that out there right now. It's a divestiture bill, right?
Right. But if the divestiture doesn't happen.
I'm putting it out there. I'm still
option.
Calling it Twitter, not X, Congressman. I have a lot of problems. Congressman Seth Moulton, it's great to see you. Welcome back to Bloomberg, the Democrat from Massachusetts, talking about many issues with us here today. And we're going to continue that conversation straight ahead with Gene Soroka from the Port in L.A. Alongside Kaylee, I'm Joe. This is Bloomberg.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do. That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Back to Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and Radio, where we were just speaking with Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton, who sits on the China Select Committee in the House, about a bill that could come to the floor this week that would ban TikTok in the U.S. if ByteDance, its Chinese owner, does not divest it. Have to be very clear that this is an if. It's not a guarantee that it will be banned. Ringing. ByteDance has a choice. The TikTokers are mad.
Yeah,
but this speaks to concern about the Chinese Communist Party that is really bipartisan here in the U.S. and how everyone is just trying to be hawkish on China pretty much all the time, Joe.
So if they did ban it, then the Trump and Biden campaigns would come off of TikTok.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they'd have to.
Well, I guess there'd be no TikTok here for that. But I don't quite understand. You know, we're talking about this even as the campaigns use TikTok to reach voters.
Right. So young voters.
Must work for something, I guess.
Sure.
But we'll find out on Wednesday.
We will find out on Wednesday. That's when Steve Scalise, the number two in the House on the Republican side, says he'll bring this to a floor. And we'll see just how bipartisan this effort is when it comes to China. But of course, there's a lot of other issues to consider when we think about the U.S. stance toward China, including when it comes to trade, Joe. That's that under the Biden administration, the tariffs that were put in place during the Trump administration have stayed. And now former President Trump, as he very likely will be the Republican nominee in November, is pushing potentially even larger tariffs that would come under a second administration. And he was actually asked about this in an interview on another network earlier today. Take a listen.
Is there no concern that China could impose retaliatory tariffs or retaliatory actions that would make doing business in China difficult for American companies, which are dependent on China for growth?
That's okay. Yeah, sure.
It's
they might do that. Even if they do, let American companies come back to America. I would say to China, if you're building a plant on our border to build cars in Mexico and to sell them into the United States, I'm putting a 50% tariff on all those cars.
He said 50, right?
Yes.
50? That's Donald Trump from earlier, a stemwinder. He was on the phone for like a half an hour. Like, where is he exactly? what phone are we doing? So there was a lot to pick through there, but he said 60% before in terms of across the board, which would result, based on the number crunching at Bloomberg Economics, would result in a divorce. That would be the end of our trade agreement, likely, or a relationship on any level.
Yeah.
Just stop all imports and exports. So you have a lot of questions here about how this would impact trade, where we would go, and what that might mean for supply chain. And that's where we start our conversation with Gene Soroka, who is with us in studio today in Washington. He runs the busiest port in America, as Kaylee mentioned, the port of L.A. And Gene, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Joe, Kaylee, good afternoon. It's great to be back in studio.
Well, sure thing. Welcome back to the nation's capital. Do you take commentary like this seriously? Because it would have a massive impact on the operations of your port.
Well, you have to, and it would absolutely be disastrous, Joe. I think the look at this is that for every four containers we move through the Port of Los Angeles, it creates one job. 60% tariffs, or whatever he's talking about, means inflation to the American consumer. Hmm. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement was designed just for this purpose, to enhance trade, and Mexico has leapfrogged China as our largest trading partner. All of this makes very little sense.
Well, you say Mexico is the largest trading partner, but surely if we were to see tariffs of this size, it would mean that there's just not a lot of trade coming from China at all, right? You would just, all of that cargo that would make its way through the Port of LA likely wouldn't be coming, right? I mean, can you quantify the amount of jobs realistically that would be lost in that scenario? If it's, what'd you say, four containers, one job?
That's right, Kaylee. One in nine jobs in Southern California rely on our ports. That's about 1 million people that go to work every day counting on us to do our job. About 57% of trade at the Port of Los Angeles back in 2022 was with China. That dropped down to 53%, so fractionally. But as you keep lopping off the top of this, it has a great impact economically and on the people that go to work every day.
Well, this is obviously something that's going to take time to figure out. It won't be until after the election, obviously, if we know this is a real conversation. Although, to Kaylee's point, the Biden administration has not relaxed tariffs left over from the Trump administration, should it?
That's right. And what we see is that there's no reason the two biggest economies in the world can't trade together. But it's been in discussions that I've had with the administration, while footwear and toys and clothing are not of consequence, where we get our chips, where we get our software is. And making sure we have rules of engagement on international trade are front of mind to the administration.
Well, of course, there was a time when you would come join us here on Bloomberg TV and radio during the aftermath of the pandemic when everything we had to ask you about was supply chain. And that also had a relation to China because China closed down a lot of production facilities because of COVID. And therefore, you know, things were delayed in getting produced and getting out of the country and into U.S. ports. Are you seeing any supply chain bottlenecks anywhere now that China has reopened? But perhaps we now have the issues of the Red Sea and ships diverting around the coast of Africa. What is happening in real time?
As always, Kaylee, there seems to be a lot on the minds of logisticians and supply chain experts. China exports were up 10% in the first 2 months of the year. And my projection for Q1 at the Port of Los Angeles is 20% growth.
Wow.
Mainly on the heels of having a long-term dock workers contract in place. We've got another 5 years of certainty with that respect. But drought in the Panama Canal, security concerns in the Red Sea with lower crossings through the Suez Canal. Most importers and exporters that I'm visiting with now on those topics are telling me they're pointing more cargo towards the Southern California gateway.
Interesting. Has the administration solved this problem? We were getting daily reports of attacks against ships by Houthi rebels. We spent some time bobbing their installations. Don't seem to be reading those stories any longer. Just to follow on to Kaylee's question, have we seen improvement there or some ships pointing back into the Red Sea?
Not really, Joe. And what we need is a global response to this.
Yeah.
When I was based in Dubai working for the private sector, American President Lines, we had meetings with NATO on a regular basis at their Africa headquarters in Djibouti. We were varying speeds and timing schedules of our vessels to protect our crew, assets, and cargo. This is not going away anytime soon.
Wow.
Many have changed their routes to go around the Cape of Good Hope, adding transit time and cost. Think of fuel burn to the supply chains coming to the East Coast and Gulf, as well as that lifeline of manufacturing to Europe.
Well, so what are they waiting for? To go back into the Red Sea?
Well, safety and security. I don't think we have any level of confidence right now that ships can pass unimpeded through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal. And again, that concern for crews is front of mind to all of us.
Well, and you mentioned how that dynamic, as well as increased volumes from China, are going to translate, you think, in your estimation, to higher volumes at your port and in ports on the California coast. And you mentioned the contract with dock workers that is now in place, but are there enough workers to go around to take those upticks in volume?
I think we're in pretty good shape.
Okay.
We're running at about 75 to 80% of normal capacity from what I see at the Port of Los Angeles. But we're not immune like anyone else in the nation. There are almost 8.9 million jobs open. We have to continue to do the best we can to attract, recruit, and retain people in our industry, from the dock workers to truckers and warehouses to the logisticians and IT specialists that we need.
Does the last mile remain the biggest challenge for you on that front?
I think really what it is, Joe, it's the velocity of cargo. If there's anything we learned from COVID, this port has to be a transit facility, not a warehouse for resting containers. We've got to balance all these interdependencies with rail, trucking, and warehouse just as much as we do getting that cargo on and off the vessels. 12,000 lifts off and onto ships coming at the Port of Los Angeles on average, that's the best in the business today.
Interesting. We also today, and you kind of jogged my memory when you were talking about investments you need to make into AI, for example, technology. Part of the budget that President Biden put forward today does include introducing kind of AI offices, even at the Department of Labor, trying to capitalize on that technology. How do you view AI changing the way that operationally ports will be handling things into the future? Does that get rid of workers, or does it just ease the operations through which they're undertaking? How is AI going to change the future of shipping?
Yeah, we cannot leave the worker behind when technology is moving faster than ever before. AI can help us with predictive and prescriptive analytics. You see something happening on a regular basis. How do you react in quicker time? That's the basis for it. With our port community system, the Port Optimizer, co-developed by General Electric, we can now see upstream some 40 days before a vessel comes into LA. Better to plan, land, equipment, and our skilled workforce. And that's in part why I'm here this week in Washington. I'm with a delegation from the Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce, led by CEO Maria Salinas. We're going to be meeting with elected officials and policymakers to campaign for more interest in the Southern California region, including our port.
We wish you luck with the meetings, of course. And while we're sitting here with Gene Sirocco, of all people, I have to acknowledge the date. We were talking about this a little bit earlier in the newsroom. March 11th, 2020 was the day the World Health Organization declared COVID a pandemic. It was on that same day. Remember, the NBA canceled the rest of its season. That same day, Tom Hanks announced he had the virus. People started to freak out. It started to feel real. It was the same day then President Trump imposed the new travel ban from Europe. Your life, your world, your whole career. And the operations of that port changed that day too, didn't they?
It sure did. And it's a very, very strong reminder of what we went through. I lived in China during SARS. And this became 100, 1,000, 10,000 times worse than what we witnessed on the ground there. Stopping all work, but having a selfless opinion of how we were going to keep the American economy moving, from our dock workers to all those in the supply chain, was just so inspiring at that time of great uncertainty.
I made us late by bringing this up, but I'm just struck by the day. Everyone should go outside, breathe fresh air. Actually, inside and breathe fresh air. Go out to dinner. Do something you couldn't do.
Stand that. Within 6 feet of other people.
That's right. You know,
hug
someone.
Do all the things we have the privilege of doing now.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.